They are often invisible, but they're everywhere. In South Africa, nearly 300,000 registered nonprofits fill the gaps where government can't or won't go. They run HIV clinics, feed hungry communities, support survivors of violence, and hold power to account. But who's holding them to account? Today on Level Up, we dive deep into the sprawling world of South Africa's NGO sector, its power, its pressure points, and its political shadow. Why did FATF say this sector could be a front for money laundering and terrorism? What does South Africa's grey listing actually mean? And what does it say about the state of our civil society? And just as we're trying to clean up the sector, the Trump administration pulls the plug on US aid, cutting off lifelines to clinics, researchers, and frontline workers across the country. The consequences? Immediate and often deadly. So, how do we protect a sector that both saves lives and risks being exploited? My guest today to help me understand the real story behind South Africa's nonprofit sector is one of the most respected voices in South Africa's civil society space, Ms. Lebo Ramofoka. She's the former executive director of Oxfam, as well as the former CEO of the Soul City Institute, where she helped shift the organization into a feminist social justice force. For nearly three decades, she's worked at the intersection of media, health, and activism, shaping policy, amplifying unheard voices, and challenging power in all its forms. From HIV clinics to climate justice, Lebo has seen how NGOs can both fill the gaps left by government and become targets in global political crossfire. So this year started off with the proper bang. I think on the 20th, first day in office, Donald Trump comes in, he's signing executive orders. And one of the main ones that stood out for a lot of people around the world and reverbed around the world was USAID.
Mm.
And then he's like,
yes,
90-day pause.
Yeah.
And then at the end of March, he's since made the announcement, told Congress that he's shutting down USAID.
Yes.
Forever. And they'll absorb other things into different departments. Which makes me think, and there was a lot said here in South Africa about the work that USAID was doing here in South Africa particularly. And so I'm interested to know, for a person like you who works with this sector, who has friends and colleagues and many stakeholders in the sector, what the impact has been now that we know this thing is gone. And now that we know Donald Trump feels the way he feels about our country, and that has an impact on lots of other funding mechanisms too in other sectors, what does that feel like? How do people in the sector feel? How has it impacted them practically, financially, and emotionally?
Yeah, it looks like 2025 has been 25 years in a few months. Because every worst nightmare has taken place. Look, I want to start here by saying, I think, you know, it is every country's responsibility to take care of its citizens. And South Africa had done well on a number of levels, including reducing its dependence on external donors. But multilateralism and the bigger global financial architecture means that there is going to be a codependency. Mm. And as a country, a global citizen, the US had established USAID that was really assisting countries to deal with a global pandemic. HIV was a global pandemic. And I want to start by saying one of the effects that I feel very strongly about is that, you know, the erasure of USAID must not erase the sacrifices that people in Southern Africa actually did to advance science globally around HIV. I remember so well when one of the studies that were done was in Khayelitsha that was testing whether or not poor women with low literacy will be able to drink the tablets and remember them. The TAC as a movement managed to do such huge treatment literacy where I was educated by those HIV positive women. So the world, including the US, is where it is right now because of unknown, unnamed HIV positive people who were in Africa, in South Africa. So the first myth we need to bust is the fact that just because they had money, that is they had everything. Mm-hmm. Okay? We are where we are in the advancement of science. People have PhDs. People are professors because the research was done on black bodies. So for me, it's a justice issue. There are black bodies that contributed to what we know about HIV right now. The knowledge creation. Orange Farm. Male medical circumcision. It was black men's penises where the foreskin was removed and people published papers. So it wasn't a begging bowl. We were not sitting as dark Africa. And it's not like we have not contributed to anything. And of course, he's also taken away money for research and stuff like that.
Yeah, because it's not just, so the aid is not just, it's not just funding yes. that only goes towards medication,
yes.
right?
It's, and it's not research, it's not unity. Yeah, it's not one direction.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, unidirectional. And I think that's important because we are where we are right now. You know, we paraded Ngozi Johnson. Okay? And I think for me, if you don't contextualize what happened in the US within the resurgence of imperialism and colonization, which is modern right now, it's called tariffs, it's called executive orders and stuff like that, is the same agenda, you know, because we absolutely contributed to the science that benefited everybody globally. It's not like all of these countries have not benefited from research, studies, professorship, papers, conferences that mainly spoke about sub-Sahara Africa.
So that actually is a fantastic place to then have this conversation, because something that was sparked by this particular executive order and USAID and PEPFAR and all of those kinds of things was also about the environment of the NGO sector in South Africa.
Yeah.
We have a lot of NGOs. I mean, we've got something like 300,000 NGOs that are registered with the Department of Social Development. And they operate in lots of different spaces.
Mm.
They get money from lots of different organizations. And this conversation conflated with the conversation that probably started in 2023 when we got graylisted, right? About money laundering and what all of these various organizations who have money coming in and going out the country, and how the NGO sector plays a role in this kind of, what would it be? This critical space in South Africa, but also in the world, because we don't have as strict a hold on who is spending what and how, and what those various money movements have impact in our politics, in our society, in our economics as well.
Mm.
Money coming in and money going out. So talk to us a little bit about the sector, the NGO sector as a whole, and how it actually works.
Yeah.
And who has what control.
Yeah. So maybe to go back to the previous organizations, I mean, the previous question, I think what I want to say is that, you know, NGOs are normally misconstrued that they are charities. NGOs are not charity. There's charity organizations, but NGOs are not charity. And I think everybody is seen as a monolithic thing, you know, and there is that culture where people are saying, oh, we remember when we were growing up, I mean, maybe I'm telling my age, you would see pictures of starving children and people would say, okay, I'll donate to that cause.
Mm.
A number of NGOs, including the TAC that I reference, dealt with the systemic issues, not the individual, let's give this. Mm. They challenged drug pricing, they challenged drug provision, and they shifted policy. And in South Africa. Hence, I started by saying we need to look at USAID and particularly the HIV program as a program where black bodies and black people contributed to knowledge, contributed to policy, and contributed. We were not there with a begging bowl. However, and this is important, and I think there's a duality in here. Firstly, to answer your second question, let me say this to you. There are different organizations. Civil society organizations. I think everybody also lumps them as NGOs. Mm. Okay? There are movements. There are people, a child gets raped, they march, they wanna support the family, they wanna, you know, do placards and stuff like that. They want to advocate for water. They want to advocate for building bridges. Just today on social media, I saw a community that fixed roads because their municipality was not doing it. You know?
In the Eastern Cape.
In the Eastern Cape. And so when a state like South Africa, you know, fails to deliver, there will be people who either rise in protest, rise in service delivery. But there is also something about how the NGO business also needs a lot of introspection. Because in a lot of ways, you would go to conferences, AIDS conferences, and big funders would be given big platforms. You know, Bill Gates, Bill Clinton. Okay, and we are sitting here and they are big ticket speakers and stuff like that. I used to find that a little bit, like, understood it, but did not, like, I did not accept it. I problematized it in my head, you know, to be saying, how much of this influence do they then have? And in fact, there have been studies made to say, once money came in for HIV, people registered NGOs, and then they were responding to proposals. And a response to proposals, we all do it, is good because it supports work that needs to be supported. But it must also take responsibility for the killing of ingenuity, for the killing of innovation. And also it will then force people who are probably just good as a movement to register an NGO. Because we don't have mechanisms in our society to support that group of women who are doing a very important thing, but they don't have a CEO, they don't have whatever.
Okay,
there is nothing corrupt about what they are doing. They are responding to a need. So everybody had to register this thing. Now, it's interesting because it's a bit of a paradox, because then even when you look at DSD, everybody calls it accountability. Mm. But very little accountability, you know, happens in terms of looking at how some of these things happen. I don't know how many people called me during COVID asking me, are you an NPO or an NPC? Why? No, because I don't know, somebody wants to put money in NPOs and stuff like that. So we can't also deny that we also created an industry that probably started being less critical but more compliant. And I'm not necessarily saying the compliance was all for bad or the compliance was around corruption, but the compliance was, I need to demonstrate that I can do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in order to do 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay?
And get X amount.
Yeah. And I'll give you an example. I was at Soul City from when I was very young. Actually, I stayed at Soul City for 24 years. Until I realized, do I want to go to heaven or hell and say the only thing that I did with my life was Soul City? Perhaps not. Let me go and spice it up a little bit and see what the other people are doing. But the point is, when funding for social change communication happened, when the funders were telling us, where's the evidence for this thing? Where's whatever? We closed programs that were good, that were shaping narrative, that were homegrown. Soul City is a South African indigenous organization that me, the thing that convinced me, I'm going to work at Soul City, was the fact that in May one day, I looked at Connie Matsunyane then on the screen. It was May, actually. It was after the. It was actually after May 5, after the inauguration of the first president, Nelson Mandela, that I was. I looked at a black person. I looked at Sister Bettina, telling my black story. I saw myself on TV, and for a country that had just become a democracy, representation mattered. Look at what we are having right now. Of course, the media space has changed, but if it's not about people being in polygamous relationships, if it's not about witchcraft, if it's not whatever, you know, so that's what happened. Yeah. And we were the show that educated people about HIV, but also community building, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I know that when I was at Soul City, because the money was going to, there's research that says this, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't follow research. But knowledge creation is political. So whose research was it? Who was determining whether or not what we are doing was worthy to be funded or not? But the point that I'm making rather is the fact that you started following the money. And it's getting harder and harder, even when USAID was here, that we were following the money to comply with what goes into these grants. Now, is it rigorous? I'm not a conspiracy theorist. You know, I can look at both sides and say perhaps, you know. But I also know that I have closed programs, not funded by USAID. And when I closed them, I was like, make it make sense. How a study done can say, we are no longer going to do region this, we are going to do region this, and this region has the more prevalence of HIV. And I'm telling somebody who's not South African, who's not African, that in fact those regions, if you go that way in your car, you are in region one. When you go this way in your car, you are in region two. They are communities, you know, and you are saying you'll do your young women's club now here or not here. I've seen programs that work close, and international funders, including our own government. I've seen programs like Soul Buddies Clubs evaluated. That shows that if a young person has ever been a member of a Soul Buddies Club, their likelihood of delaying sex is high. They were not evaluated a week after the intervention. Yeah. They were tracked longitudinally after a while. You are most likely to finish high school. You are most likely to delay sex compared to people who are not a member of a club. That is data, South African data. Research also shows where the evidence is collected and who gets this research to compile the evidence. So the point I'm making is the fact that, you know, we have seen how money coming in has enabled a lot of good things. But we've also seen how programs that could have, and it has been with the support of our government. When I worked, I've seen a parenting intervention, for an example, closed because there was another parenting intervention. We were told it's evidence-based. It was tested in other countries. And then our own government said, no, we will take on that program. And then our homegrown one done in partnership with the Children's Institute was stopped because we are now adopting this model. Mm-hmm. So that ingenuity, creating our own knowledge from the bottom, testing things. I mean, right now, I've gotten into the issue into the field of innovation. And what I like about innovation is its agility, but what I also like is failing fast, you know? So we had to fill in logical frameworks that basically says, I know if I did this, this will happen. And when I write your report, I must show you that I did this and that would happen. That's not what the innovation and the startup phase is doing. You've got a hypothesis, you test it. And that's where innovation comes in.
But then the mistrust is not misplaced, as it were, because there is now this whole conversation around who funds what and why they fund it. And the following the money, as you are explaining it to me now, also the mistrust that the South African public has suddenly got that says, yeah, these people come and they tell us this and this and this, and we must do that because they're putting money into that space.
No, the South African public, the South African public is lousy. Mm. I'm sorry to say it. You know, I think we are just such thumb activists. Nobody has gone to the streets, including myself, to go and say, government, what are you going to do? I read articles written by well-respected people. I see some conspiracy theorists. We are now so woke and Africanist and stuff like that. The truth of the matter is there is a large amount of money that went into life-saving programs that by closing, some people said, we can no longer fill our script for HIV. You can't be woke on social media when there are people who depended on that clinic that was well run. Because let's face it, these NGOs ran good clinics. Services for sex workers that nobody is now going to pay for. And you are also then sitting with a government that has not said it's an emergency. I have had a number of people. I went walking with a friend of mine who's a specialist pediatrician. We met no less than specialist black women doctors whose jobs had just ended. Daily Maverick or Amabungane, I don't remember, had an article about how in the budget speech we've got unemployed doctors in South Africa. And how, and so the USAID, you know, has stopped this very good clinics. Mm. And I think government is only able to either take 800 or 1,200 doctors, you know. so we can't be sitting here and be, because we are going to see babies dying. Mm. We take it for granted now that HIV became a chronic illness. People's life expectancy. We had problems that U equals U. Mm. If your viral load is undetected, because you have been on antiretrovirals, you are not going to infect your partner for as long as you take your treatment, okay? So what it does is that at a population level, at a public health level, the chance of people infecting people gets completely reduced, okay? Gets completely reduced to a point that if you were to have sex with somebody without a condom, because many people still do that, if they were on treatment, the chances of being infected would go lower. But very recently, I think it was in February, the Minister of Health, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, launched a 1 million campaign to say we probably have a million people who are not on treatment. So what has gone is a public health crisis. So we cannot afford, as South Africans, as critical as we may be of money, of US aid and stuff like that, to be so blasé that we don't see the immediate, you know, the brain drain of doctors who may leave the country, of black female, you know, of doctors who studied so much, who have expertise, nurses equally, just that workforce that we may just lose. Because remember, they were not running private clinics. They were running the public sector. In many instances, they were running clinics even at night. They were servicing what is now called key populations. Once you remove that, you know, and you don't treat it as an emergency, you are busy in conspiracy theories and, you know, you are pontificating and stuff like that. And so I don't like this kind of, you know, what's the English word now? You know, where it's like black and white. There's a lot of grace in this whole issue. I can be critical of funding, and I'm critical of USAID, and I'm critical of our government, you know, as I'm talking about programs that have closed and stuff like that, because it's not like our government was not there. And I can also say government in South Africa has reduced to a large extent its dependence on foreign money. But I'm saying even if we were taking 10% only, its impact when you can't absorb these doctors, when our healthcare system is falling apart in the way that you are unable to absorb those people. The issue is not going to be only you. The issue is you, you equals you will fall away. Mm-hmm. And that very South African doesn't want to use a condom. That very South African doesn't want to stick to one partner. In fact, we've made it very sexy to have partners for every day of the week and maybe some days have two partners for the day. You know? So what's going to happen is mm-hmm. that you are going to see we had a generalized epidemic. Mm-hmm. What that meant is that generally speaking, you can assume that we all have HIV. Though that treatment absolutely had a gap. Okay? Mm-hmm. We were told, involved in social change work, that work, you know, there isn't evidence, blah, blah, blah. And in a lot of ways, I supported that, except that at that time we treated it as an either or. But here's the thing, just to finish my point. The point is we did know that in a very patriarchal, misogynistic country like ours, a lot of women would not be able to negotiate yeah. safer sex. And that is why the more we had advances around treatment, you know, including PrEP, including other things, we knew we were making rational decisions.
What then? So then, Covadis, the government is also on its own side not filling that gap. International funding has left. And we are in a crisis, or are we in a recalibration? Is it a crisis? Or
I think it's a crisis.
Recalibration.
I think it's a crisis because I have not seen government say, hey, this is going to be our response. I think there's something about South Africa for me right now, even with America. Like, I mean, America has said, and AfriForum and all other people have said a whole lot of things. And here's a theory, and it's a theory. It's not a conspiracy theory, but it's a theory nonetheless. I think we are so used to crisis that any crisis that happens is like, oh, another one. And then we move on. Potholes, oh, okay. GBV, oh, okay. I don't see the urgency of a country. I don't see, and I've seen articles, one of them, written by Francois Fenta, you know, who was really at the forefront of many of these interventions, of the government saying to people, okay, fine, guys, the Treasury is going to release this money. Hang on. This is what we are going to do. Don't close that clinic. Don't do this. Like, fine. I don't see it. So it's a crisis, as far as I'm concerned. But it almost seems like we are basically saying, oh, another one. You know, it's like, for an example, going to a South African police station or the hospital on a Friday evening, and where now you are shocked that one person is sitting with an X in the head, another one is bleeding there, and the nurses are joking and eating and going past. They are used to these things. Where now when you are new there, you are like, oh my goodness, why is there no image? It's, no, it's like this. And I think that is the analogy I have. That is South Africa is like, I'm very worried about. And the problem that I have is that I think the effects of this, unless we treat it as an emergency, unless as a citizenship we demand answers from our own government, we demand answers from Treasury. But look, I mean, the budget is not yet passed. You know, that is why I'm saying we look and we say, oh, another crisis. Oh, it's another happening. One. Yeah, put it on that pile, you know, of crises. But we need to treat some of these things as an emergency.
So your experience cuts across health, gender equity, and also social justice, right? So you've been outside of your Soul City work, you've also been at Oxfam, and you've been a strategic advisor in multitudes of a non-profit as well as social change organizations. This sector, as it were, what is it that we need to get right to shift it from a sort of trusted environment to something that we can bring into in our everyday lives, that we understand the critical space that it plays without worrying that it is also used in nefarious ways?
many people that have looked at the civil society space as being used in nefarious ways have nefarious intentions themselves. You know, like when you hear, for an example, politicians saying, "And oh, and these NGOs." I know that it's a code of saying we don't want to be watched. We don't want accountability. Because let's face it. I mean, remember, is it right to know? This country wanted to stifle our access to information. There was a secrecy bill. That's when I started hearing this, oh yeah, you know, these NGOs are foreign funded. And I just rolled my eyes and I'm like, please, if you were doing your job, there would be no need for foreign funding. We're a middle income country. If money was not lining wrong pockets, there wouldn't be any need. If you had thought about illicit financial flows, there would be no need. Like, do you want me to give you 5 ways in which you could make sure that there isn't? But you are not going to use NGOs as a scapegoat for challenging accountability. Does this mean that as a sector, as NGOs, there isn't a space to reflect? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I think any industry, any sector, anything that happens, the one thing that is guaranteed is change. Change is a constant. But again, it's not that kind of black and white thing where you say, ha, look at what happened, you know. And I think we need to have nuanced conversations. And the first nuanced conversation, and I'm very happy and proud to be the chairperson of the board of Hlanganisa Community Fund. It's a fund that recognizes that largely movements that are really, really doing good work can't access the funding. People who don't necessarily want to register and have all of these things, you know, really who are doing good work. So how do you get the money flow from big organizations or whatever right into the hands of people? Because it's important that you do that. The second thing that needs to happen is that there is a lot of organizations that are doing service delivery that government should be doing. I am so happy with what happened with the budget vote right now. I mean, I think it's a bit nonsensical and childish that when the VAT was reversed, every party was saying, oh, it was me. Oh, it was me. Oh, it was me. No, it was a lively democracy. The rules that were there around parliament's oversight on all of this have always been there. You know, it's just that it was comfortable before, you know, to use it. And once you cancel that noise, the idea that all political parties and civil society organizations need to think about where's the money going to come from? How are we spending the money? Is a very good one. And I think there are organizations that are doing tax work that are really, really doing good work. And that work needs to happen, you know. But there's also, especially in this opportunity of the G20 in South Africa, and I'm so happy that the AU is part of this. So it's G20 plus one because the AU is also that. Is that what the AU is putting on the table and a number of regional organizations, because other NGOs really do good research. So they are not going to do service provision on the ground. They are not movements on the ground, but they do amazing research. The Institute of Economic Justice, you know, AfroDebt, they have been tracking debt in Africa. And another myth that we must bust, we are not a begging bowl. Countries, including America, including Singapore and whatever, do take out debt. That's the international financial architecture. But the secrecy and the unfairness of how that debt is being serviced, you know, for African countries is a problem. And also how some of these financial institutions will also force governments who take these loans to apply austerity measures. And the amount of money that we use to service debt basically is money that could have gone into health, into education. So even with USAID, you can't really think about USAID in isolation of the bigger global financial architecture, the illicit financial flows. And one of the campaigns that Oxfam runs that I absolutely support is taxing the super rich. If we increase the tax of the super rich globally, developing countries, global South countries, would be able to finance. We wouldn't need a USAID. So there is something at a very bigger policy level where NGOs are creating think tanks, they are creating research that other NGOs who want to participate in this, including the G20, can really use and basically say, where is our money going? We launched a report with the International Economic Justice on where was the transparency on the loans around the vaccines that we took, you know. There is another organization, I forget its names, I'm very bad at names, that started, that looks at, you know, the trade tariffs that we play. So the world is not fair. And big business has something to benefit, so they are not going to question the financial architecture. And you can see it. You know, I listened to that very initial budget speech before it was postponed to the 12th of March. And I heard the minister of thinking argue. And I know, and I had the fortune at the time that I was still at Oxfam to have interacted with organizations that, or with the campaign of tax, the super rich were saying, no, we couldn't increase taxes for businesses because we want to stimulate, investment. I'm like, really? Really? This economy has not grown. So the point I'm making is the fact that these NGOs that are think tanks, that are doing the research, are challenging things and are invited and are sitting at tables where some of this work is taking place. But there's other organizations, the bulk that Hlanganisa is supporting, that are also watchdogs. Democracy is not about employing a camp like the king or a group of people. We've learned it with the ANC. We trusted these people. They were black like us. Huh? Some of our parents and grandparents remember them because, I mean, Mandela was in jail. Oh, you know, Utata. Oh, these white people. Hey, bana. They showed us a thing or two.
A couple of things.
These people who look like us. And you then realize that, in fact, and hence my point about tax, a democracy that is vibrant is a democracy that allows movements. And globally, this is the time to support movements, whether the movements are in Brazil, whether the movements are anywhere else in the world. Look at what the young people did in Kenya. Kenya was also going crazy about taxes, by the way. The young people brought it down. That's movements, you know. And maybe what we need to do is to think not in a black and white issue about the NGO sector. I do think that the NGO sector is at a place of critical reflections. The INGOs and their role. How much money stays somewhere there before it trickles down to people?
Absolutely. Money that gets all of allocated that for office work and not really for program work.
All of that is important reflections. And I do know that those conversations are taking place and people are grappling, you know, with them.
So do you think that it was unfair and maybe punitive to an extent when South Africa gets grey listed and the number one red flag that is then put to South Africa to say you've got to fix this particular sector in the illicit financial flows and the funding of terrorism becomes the NGO sector? Do you think it was unfair? And do you think that the government's knee-jerk response of then, I mean, they've deregistered something like 20,000 NGOs since November last year. And all of the, what they call the tightening of the screws around this thing. Do you think it's unfair?
I always struggle to give yes or no answers. So here's the thing. I mean, do we monitor compliance of anything in this country, in a way where we can be very confident that it's done? We, I mean, remember the hearings about the SABC and things that happened at the SABC? We could hardly monitor what was happening when in fact there are instruments, you know, that exist. So our monitoring of everything is poor. does it mean that, you know, all NGOs or the NGO sector is the only place that needs to be monitored? I would say no. I think sometimes we have a knee-jerk response, you know. We absolutely just want to say, and I think sometimes, and thank God to, you know, the veracity of our laws is that sometimes we want to just react. And I'm sure, don't tell people I said this, I think sometimes some people in government, you know, would think, hey, we wish they did not have as many rights. You know, our laws would not be.
There is a certain former president who tells us all the time that he would love to be a dictator for a little while.
You know what I mean? and so I do think that some of those sentiments were ill-founded. Mm. However, I mean, for me, NPOs, and I think we need to be, there's NPCs and NPOs. Mm. Churches register as NPOs. Mm-hmm. Let's follow the Omotoso case. When it started, I remember there was one time I went and I accompanied Minister Batabile Dlamini then, who was at Social Development, to the case. One of the things that the ANC could have done, I mean, apart from the fact that this case was just bungled, and GBV is something that when I talk about, I get very hot. It's a personal thing.
Hot under the collar.
Hot under everything. But the point I wanted to make is that we couldn't even regulate how you register churches here. Mm. Now, you want to talk about illicit financial flows? Look in the churches. And it's something that can be done easily. I think Rwanda has done it. Where people are getting hurt. Mm. People are getting hurt. We see on social media and we laugh, doom and stuff like that. And that is why for me, I'm saying, compliance is exactly that, you know. So let's start. How many churches have been registered? How many churches? Every other corner is a church. Every other disused building is a church, you know. So God is an amazing marketing tool. And we absolutely do not know what happens in these churches. What has happened to life as it is many? So you see, for me, it's you can't talk about the lack of monitoring and accountability, protecting the vulnerable, when you just can't do two things. Life as it is many. Mental health, psychiatric help, people who are ECD, early childhood development. You know, anybody can open a creche. Right now, I know there's a regulation, but also that's what we do. We then will do regulation that is so difficult to comply with that people will just do their own thing. Because, hey, I mean, it's like when you are trying to get a
forms.
Yeah, when you are trying to get a driver's license in South Africa, or you are trying to have your child get a driver's license, the system is so rigged that you will end up saying, yo, who can we pay now? And they make it so difficult that you yourself... It's the same as the borders. You know, right now there's this sentiment, Mabahambe, whatever, whatever. There wouldn't be an illegal immigration problem in South Africa if our own South Africans were not corrupt from top to toe. We benefit. There's been stories of people getting IDs so that they vote for particular parties. I have been part of one experience, but many people talk about it, about how when you are with a foreign national with proper papers, they will create something so that that person will pay a bribe. We do know that Home Affairs officials will make foreign nationals pay money for a process that is not paid for. We know what we do.
Yeah.
So for me, it's accountability. So grey listed because there's terrorist organizations. I don't think the South African government knows who's in South Africa and what they are doing, because they've stopped caring. I mean, I was deleting things. I've been doing a lot of clearing. And I saw some articles that I had kept. I'm sure 5 years before this now round of tuck shops.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think 5, if not 10 years ago. And I'm like, I looked at it. And I'm like, is this date wrong? Because this thing is recent, it's very recent, that tuck shop. I'm like, shucks, this is the second one, or third, or fourth, you know? And so there's like, yee, you know, yee. and nothing happens.
Everything is an excitement.
Everything must be an emergency. And then after that little excitement, we live. But there is no consistent implementation. And in many instances, like things like GBV, I don't think there's political will.
Speaking of political will, lots of talk, and you spoke a little bit about TAC and movements that have been driving forces for change in policy. There's also lots of talk about should the NGO sector, non-profit sector, be apolitical? And I'm interested.
The personal is political. The personal is political. For me, party politics is the problem. Party politics is the problem. But everything is political. Internationally, when you go to the UN Security Council and you are advocating for Gaza, for an example, it's a political statement. Whether you are a doctor, whether you are a humanitarian organization, you are, because there are vested interests, it is going to become political what NGOs do. We are not charities. It goes back to what I said to you. We take a particular stance on certain issues. I sometimes find that there are even some conversations, even family conversations, I cannot be a part of. Okay? Because I actually know I've taken a particular stance. And as I grow older, I then realize, well, your stance is not everybody else's stance. But when I fight for my stance, I fight for it like my life depends on it. I was hurt by that festival, by that boy who used to beat up Rihanna. Whatever that stadium.
Chris Brown.
That one. Yes, you see even his name. You know what I mean? And I know people are crazy about him. You know, we've had very well-known professors say, hey, it's my money and I'm going. You know, and hey, we got into that, you know. And I know, so I know how NGOs like Women for Change were absolutely dragged by so-called influential, I don't know, these boys with tattoos that are on social media and they get followers, you know, say, which organization is this? Mm-hmm. You know, why are they? And so Is that not political? It's very political. Mm-hmm. The work of social justice is a political act. And you learn very fast, particularly now, in the era of disinformation, in the era of social media, that people will come at you. You know, I mean, right now we've had a very misogynistic platform that has always been misogynistic. Mm-hmm. You know, calling out one person, the deputy minister of women, say no. You know, come and explain how you can do that. I follow how Steve is being dragged. You know, that's political. How are you apolitical when you are standing for apolitical? For me means let's see. This one is fine. This one is fine. We've got strong opinions about things. That's why we get into social justice, and we know that the social justice. And sometimes we find out the hard way. Some of us, at least. The hard way, that some of the positions that we hold, you will be silenced. They will come after you, you know, and it's been an interesting era for me, how I've seen how people have come for me, you know, because you stand for certain things. So it will always be political.
So how would you, if you could wave a wand, what is the one thing you would want South Africans as a whole to understand about the sector of the non-profit sector, the NGO sector, social justice movements that South Africans understood better and were able to advocate positively?
I'm going to answer your question with somebody's analysis of what happened in Brazil. I think you look at voter turnout, you look at whatever, there is a complacency in society. I see it mainly around younger people who say, you know, what is like a general mistrust in the election process. a general mistrust in the democratic process and instruments. And part of it, I understand it. I think I remember when I was still at Soul City, we educated young women about their rights. And one of the things that we taught them about, they were doing a community-based monitoring process about the NDPs, Integrated Development Plans, IDPs, mm-hmm. Integrated Development Plans. And because they had received the information, they attended an IDP in some place in the Northwest. And they were told, no, this is not your space. They wow. reported it back. And after reporting it back, we basically wrote them a letter to say you are breaking the law. The IDP is where you come to your people and you basically say, this is the budget that we have.
Yes, how as do you a municipality. Develop? How yeah. do you develop no, without talking no, to the people?
No, they develop, they take the money and they report. They can tell you that there is a light bulb when communities know that this lights, we didn't even know that there used to be a light here. And it's because we have a system where there is no accountability and monitoring where you could, I mean, how are we finding that money was spent for a stadium, $2 billion, but in fact, there's grass.
Stadium.
There's grass. We are like that. Mm-hmm. Né? But so I understand how difficult, you know, and also crony, you know. Mm-hmm. So I would see people all of a sudden, they are getting tenders and all of a sudden they are wearing a particular T-shirt.
Have 20 cars.
No, not even those. Those, whatever. But I'm just saying that even in the communities, in the townships, people will thrive by, like, I can't oppose. Mm. So I must just toe the line, wear the T-shirt, you know, because to even get an EPWP job, I can't be seen to not be. So it goes to that granular level mm-hmm. where positions are used to, you know, divvy out whatever little resources there is. So I'm not even talking about big tenders. We read about those. We know about those. So that's what you are finding. So I can understand the difficulty with it. But I also think that there is a particular complacency. And if we really don't engage with these organizations, because in a lot of these organizations, you find old women. Women globally, especially black women, carry society politically. It's proven. It's there. You look at organizations that deal with people living with disabilities, that are feeding children, that are whatever. It's black women, largely, who are running these organizations because there is a need, they are responding. And so the complacency, while you can see where it comes from, particularly from younger people, people are going to get into the streets and appreciate the sector once it's taken away. And when Lula was put in jail, and then there was the president that replaced them mm-hmm. in Brazil. Brazilians are telling you that for the first time we understood what it means to have repression. And so when Lula came back, people were like, never again. You know, must we experience what we had experienced? And, you know, I see people toying around, including white people in South Africa. And I feel very sorry for the white people in particular who now have this narrative that they are the oppressed. Mm. The oppressed. And silly. Cyril. Cyril, who understands markets? Mm. Cyril, who understands and is going to be very nice to capital? Mm. You are being oppressed. And you are going to be talking about farms when I was asking questions, even coming into here, about how do people acquire this kind of properties, walking in here, where we are sitting. And I was asking because I looked and I'm like, ooh, but whom? And you are saying you are victims. I don't want to sound like our parents because I think what they did, as we now know, because we know better, was not right. But they would find you crying and say, hey, must I give you a reason to cry? The point I'm making is that somebody will come and give us a reason to cry. And I do think that it's a pity that part of what is happening right now, the era of disinformation and ultra-right wing is a global one. And it's a pity that, you know, you've got platforms like X and other ones that fuel it. And that social media, you know, with all these algorithms, if you are a misogynist, you'll get feeds from misogynists. If you are, you know, racist, you'll get those feeds. So we the polarization using these platforms now. Like you can, I'm sure if you are a racist, you can connect with racists from everywhere. Look at that one that was uncovered. 46 years old, has never worked. Runs their mothers and fathers. And it's basically saying I'm a victim. I looked at it, I'm like, which black parent 46 years ago could buy land and game lodges for their child to run? Because you see me, I don't want to do social justice. I want to run my mother and father's game lodge, personally myself. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, as they would say in Afrikaans, the purpose I'll dance one day when we have complacent. And then we are then going to be forced to take drastic measures. And it's similar to our government. The Pope danced a little bit with the elections when all of a sudden, you know, the ANC lost the majority. And I give the ANC credit because, in fact, in other countries, it would have gone to war, you know, because they lost the majority. I'm very proud to be a South African, as messy as the GNU was. Because I think sometimes people, you know, like, oh, this thing doesn't work and stuff like that. Well, people did not go to war. You know, you did not see the military saying, you know, what do you mean? There's no clear winner. We are taking this thing. We did not see that. And that is something worth celebrating. Is it messy right now? Yes, it's very messy. Is it frustrating? Yes. But the point of the matter is we need to support democracy, a thriving democracy. NGOs are doing that. We need to support critical thought around social justice. Think tanks and NGOs are doing that. We need to challenge companies like Shell. Human rights defenders are doing that. We need to make sure that we take our governments to court so that children do not fall in pit latrines. It's not a victory of the DA and the DA minister that we are eliminating pit latrines. This idea that politicians say, me. No, no, nobody has a magic wand. We give credit to the boy and the family, as tragic as it was, who fell in the pit latrine. Equal Education took the minister to court. This country, we're going to, I think, appeal. Or they did something like that. So you can't come as a minister coming tomorrow and say, look, we did it. No.
They were held accountable.
It started with civil society exposing. So democracy, as I said, it's not a king. We don't elect a king. I think we were very naive. They look like us. They sound like us. They're going to do better with us. They tasted money and said, animal farm. All animals are equal. But others are more equal than whatever. They all went to Dubai and they're like, yo, kumnandi la. It's nice. And they abandoned us. Do you understand what I'm saying? The movements, human rights defenders, the NGO space is what is going to say. We need to understand how democracy works and how right to know. And we've got, fortunately in South Africa, so many good examples. Even of people, I mean, I was at the birthday party for Albie Sachs, okay? Who says when he's, that stayed with me so much. Who says when he was, you know, the bomb came and then.
The letter bomb.
Yeah, the letter bomb. And I think he had been in hospital for a while and his comrades came to see him and they basically said to him, you know, they found the guys and stuff like that. And, you know, might of the law, whatever. He says, no, that is not victory. Victory for me will be when South Africa was free. And to walk into the Constitutional Court, just there by Hillbrow, it's not even in the posh suburbs, and sit there and really inform case law. It's not a mean feat. And I think that is why political education, people's education is going to be so important. Because sometimes I speak to young people and I'm like, what have we done? what have we done? Because I don't know what happened here, but I don't know. The lights are on, yeah. but nobody's here. We are looking at fashion. We want to be the next influencer. But it's like, yo, why are you being a slave to capital? But you know, so the point I'm making is the fact that, like, a vibrant democracy is about movements. It's about NGOs. It's about think tanks that are non-governmental. It's robust. And it's also about solidarity. In our region, SADC, it's solidarity in our continent, Africa. It's solidarity in the global south. Because some of the problems that we are facing right now, climate change, it's everywhere. The least polluters are going to be paying the most price for the climate change that we are seeing. The digitization of labor is going to affect all of us. Issues of hunger and food production as a result of climate change is going to affect all of us. So you do need that solidarity. And it's a pity because so much of business and capital is so close to to governments that it will take NGOs. But this moment with Trump, with the ultra-right wing, you know, growing not only in the US but other countries in the global north electing ultra-right governments means that there is a lot of introspection as a sector that we need to have. There's conversations, whether you are an international NGO, a local NGO, a CBO, that we're going to have. And yes, you know, somebody wrote an article on LinkedIn around the system is broken, but the people in the system also benefit from the system. So fixing the system may not be a priority right now because it's people's careers, people's jobs, people's sense of identity. And I can tell you some of them are very difficult. You know, I sometimes ask myself, who are you outside of working in this sector? And sometimes the answer you realize that, oh my goodness, my identity is so much matched with the sector. But I also realize that, and that's why I started where I started. You know, we contributed to some of these things and we can't just let them go in our lifetime. So it's not black and white. But yeah, we magic wand, your democracy is vibrant and kept alive by movements, by NGOs that are really making a big difference, including service provision. In some instances.
I think that is a perfect place to end the conversation. And thank you so much for taking the time and chatting with us about all of this and kind of painting a really vivid picture of what is happening out there and what some of these things mean away from the noise of social media or executive orders. So thank you for coming in.
It's always a pleasure chatting to you.
Oh, I love you. Thank you.